Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello!
And Brian Brushwood.
It's true. I don't have any eyes.
Oh, it's sad. It's sad. But I'm going to move right along from that tragedy. It's amazing. So actually, speaking of saying things like that is, I got to hang out with Amazing Jonathan last night. And if you're talking to him and somebody comes up in the middle of conversation, he'll go like, no, I'll tell you about my cancer later. And I watched him three times. He did that to people. And they're like, oh my God. And I'm like, it's him. Don't.
That's
and
amazing.
Like, I was tired of hearing about it, really.
For those who don't know, Amazing Jonathan is a truly hilarious and incredible magician who recently gave a extremely moving talk, TED Talk style presentation. It wasn't TED, it was another thing, in which he said, yeah, I'm going to die. I'm going to die and sooner rather than later. I guess he's doing a little bit better and is actually talking about he's performing more now.
Well, he will do. There's an event called Brooklidge where it's this sort of like kind of specialty sort of variety show in LA, in a theater. It's just more kind of a fun, get a bunch of cool variety performers. And he's kind of hosted a couple of those, but he's not doing his full hour and a half show or whatever. So, you know, but he's still doing stuff and it's fun, you know, fun to hang around him. So I want to, but by the way, if you've never heard of Amazing Jonathan, go to YouTube.
A legend. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, his half hour on Comedy Central was among one of my favorite things in comedy. Forget magic. I think it was like the Lounge Lizards set. Like it was just something that I watched over and over and over and over and over again. He is, just genre defining.
One of my favorite moments, I'll tell you last night, is he does a bit and he borrows a $20 bill from somebody. He rips it up and then he ends up taping it back together and giving it to them, right? And it's the way it's done, it's hilarious, whatever. And so he's up on stage, says, I need to borrow a $20 bill. And I'm like, I know where this is going. I'm not going to give him my 20 bucks. And the guy who gave him $20 is a well-known magician who has actually published an entire book on like bill magic. And he... They had no idea. It was hilarious. I watch him get up on stage, give him the bill, and I'm like, I don't think he knows what's about to happen. And Jonathan tears it up, tapes it up, and hands it back to him. And this guy's looking down at the bill like, wait, where's the trick? This is it? And then later on, he goes to Jonathan, like, can you switch this for a 20? He's like, no. It was the perfect person that happened to. I was dying.
Yeah, like, no, in the state 20. That it comes back, like it's all crumpled up and held together with like, you know, opaque electrical tape. I mean, yeah, it's not.
It's just a ball
pieces.
Of tape with the bills sticking out of it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. I want to give you guys an update. So I've been working on this author page project, right, which is make it easy for authors to create web pages for their books, to promote themselves and to do that. I've been a little bit digging into sort of like the some of the code there, making a very easy way to display text. I think I showed this before, kind of like an auto ebook sort of function. So it goes through it, you know, on any device, it will sort of read like a Kindle, which has been challenging because I've got to figure out how to do the displays and stuff. But I'd promised that we were going to be doing, you know, some sort of announcement, you know, or letting more people into the beta probably like 2 weeks ago. And I didn't do it because I said, I want to just fix a couple more things, but that is going to be very soon. I actually have a book I've got to turn around in the next couple of days, but I'm going for the next, hopefully in the next week or so to say, hey, everybody, let's bring more people in the beta. The nervous part for me is the fact that these are people, a lot of them I don't know. You know, we have beta users right now who are people who are connected to myself or Peter J. Wax, my partner in the project, and then going to that next step of inviting in strangers to use it where it's like, okay, that's going to be kind of terrifying. But what I wanted to get to was address sort of as you do something, you start to see where there's a need or there's an interesting market or opportunity. And as I've been doing AuthorPage, I've found there's been an enthusiasm for sharing short stories. A lot of authors who maybe don't write books have been very enthusiastic about the idea of sharing short stories there. We're working with an organization, a very, very big writers organization, and one of the head of this organization is extremely well known for her short stories and stuff, and that was enthusiastic to her because we're trying to create the best reading experience you possibly can for like web and just reading short stories without having to download something. There is no marketplace for short stories. There is effectively no place you go to buy short stories. If you're an author and you want to release stuff in a serialized format, let's say you wanted to do, you know, a story that not necessarily was a novel, but maybe was contained in 10 to 15,000 word sections, there's nothing. Now, you can go to Amazon and you could sell stuff for like 99 cents, but the problem in the Amazon model is you only make 30 cents. So if you sell it for a buck, you make 30 cents. The only way you start to make a majority of the money is if you go to $3 or $2.99 or more, and then you get 70% of that. But there isn't really a large-scale marketplace for selling short stories. Yet there has been – short stories have been an important part of the fiction landscape for a long time. You used to get magazines, and magazines would include short stories. There would be entire, you know, very popular magazines dedicated to that stuff. Now as we've moved into the digital age where it's harder to price those things, it hasn't happened as much. I want to, and Peter and I've talked about this, the idea of add a component to author page where we make it very easy for people to sell short stories or novellas or novelettes, books under like 40,000 words for under the $3 price point. And one, I want to get your reaction on that. Two, next steps.
Well, I mean, I think that there's definitely, you've identified a pain point, right? In that there, the landscape for fiction sales in general has kind of always been fractured because it's been so controlled for so long. I mean, like, there is a place where people sell short stories. It's just normally you sell them to some company that makes a compilation or you sell them to a magazine, right? In mm-hmm. a world in which those are not the only two ways to do it, there is a lot of daylight there, theoretically. The big key would be just, you know, building the audience for it. Right. And then figuring out whether or not they want to buy and if this is something that they do want to buy. I suspect that it would be, though.
So is the question whether or not to build in an integrated short story sales platform to AuthorPage?
We're going to build in the ability for authors certainly to sell stuff. And we've been talking to PayPal and people there. We want to do kind of an adaptive payments thing so people get paid automatically. Ideally what'll work is if somebody buys it from you, you would create an account, you put your PayPal, you know, your PayPal email address in there. Somebody buys it from you, we get a small percentage, then you get paid automatically. Not we pay you 30 days later or 60 days or whatever. We kind of want to get rid of that sort of system, and we want to use the technology that's out there to make it much, much easier to do that. And so it's immediate. One of the things we found that people have been using it love is we give immediate stats. So when you put out a post or mention something, immediately what happens is you see how many people have gone there. So when I put up my Mars post, I'm seeing in real time how many people are reading it. When I mention a book or whatever like that, I can see stuff happen. So it's been very cool. As far as the model we want to use is we want to use PayPal. PayPal does micropayments, which means you can on things under $10, the transaction fees are much less. It's 5 cents plus 5% versus 30 cents plus 3 cents. If you wanted to sell something for a buck using PayPal without micropayments, you're going to lose 33 cents on every sale, mm-hmm. which means there's no margin. There's no economy for doing that, which as I've been reading about, you know, the early days of the internet, and one of the things people hoped for was to create microtransactions for content. And we have an entire economy built around advertising where there could be an alternate universe where we had an economy based upon the idea of, you know, paying 3 cents, 5 cents, 10 cents for an article. But the problem is that we couldn't get to that point because credit card transaction fees and all that were so high that we never saw that version of the world.
And
maybe
that's,
it wouldn't.
That's tough. I don't know that I would normally suggest this kind of scheme, but it seems tough to remind people that paying for short stories is a thing that is not outrageous. Like even it used to be that you would buy a magazine. So which in your mind, you're buying the magazine and the short story was just one of the things that was in the magazine, right? And there'd be credit that would go, you know, to that author. They would get paid by the magazine or whatever. Like, I don't know that I want to pony up 60 cents or a dollar or whatever to read a short story, but I would like to you know, just chip in $5 to author page, full stop. And then while I'm in author page, be able to do some kind of version of, you know, giving somebody Reddit gold or karma or whatever.
Yeah, I don't think that's tried, and I don't think that'll work. I think that's been a scheme that's been tried before, where you create accounts and stuff like that. And I think the problem is we tend to think of it in the abstract, the idea that I don't think I want to consume a story that way. But if you took – if all of a sudden you knew that Ernie Cline had published a really cool 20,000-word novella and it was $2.
And Ernie Cline's cell phone didn't work, so you couldn't just ask – for it for free.
Okay. Well, I said a lot of people, not Brian. The point is then if it's in the abstract, the answer is like, yeah, I don't think I want to. But if it's in the specific, if like I said to people like, hey, I've got these things that I think are really high value. They're 15,000-word stories. It's an hour and a half fun reading. It's a 99-cent thing. You know, you download it, you can read it just like a book. Same formats, goes into your Kindle, goes everywhere. And 99 cents is how I made my career as a writer, by the way.
Sure.
Well, so that's kind of the thing. But the problem is that Amazon has taken all the profit. You know, they push people into the higher – and rightfully so in many cases. They've tried to push the price per point on books to $6, $5, whatever, because there's a much better value proposition there. And I think that was wise to do that. But there hasn't been this really good ecosystem, even really historically, for short story stuff. But I think there's an incredible market for that now, as you look at the way people do things and in-game apps. And if you have stories and fiction that's serialized, and the most of modern fiction was based on the serialized model, where you would buy an edition of a newspaper or a magazine every month because it had the next installment of, you know, a Jules Verne story or something to that degree.
I don't think that there is anything controversial in the idea that more micro. I mean, we already see, like you pointed out, we've already seen some level of micropayments in the rise of the $1 to $2 ebooks on Amazon, right? Like there is obviously a market, a thirst for people to pay that, and I think now that it is saturated enough, there is certainly a place where you could say, yeah, I want to spend 60 cents, I want to spend 90 cents on a shorter version of something. Now, as to you guys being the place to sell it, I do think that you need the audience there first. I don't know if you attract the audience with it.
I think that and I don't know that that's, you know, my model is the idea that first is we allow people, we say on your own author page, you can enable your own shopping cart to sell your books and stuff like this and any size thing you want. And if you want to do short, if you want to do books, things like that, it's the same rate as Amazon. If you want to do short stories, we'll have a much more attractive rate. And the idea that then I as an author would be saying, telling people, I'd be on Twitter like, hey, I've got a new short story here. You know, read the first 500 words for free. If you want to get the rest, it's 99 cents. Go to my page to get it. And that's what Author Page has been focused on, is the idea is helping authors become the center point for their fans and going there. Yeah. Not go to Amazon first, but go to my page first to get this thing. And so that's the goal, is just to say, let's do a Shopify kind of thing for authors. Let's fulfill that. When we say, man, we got a lot of good content here, you know, I have the domain shorterfiction.com, as we can say, yeah, we can list it there in shorterfiction.com. I don't think, you know, I don't think we'll, you know, if we say let's launch shorterfiction.com and everybody there, you need to have the content there, and the content won't be there until authors are creating stuff for it. But if we're encouraging authors to say, here's your own store, here's your own ecosystem that functions here, and if you want, check this box, we'll put it in this other place too.
Do we have any data on how popular Amazon Kindle singles are, or how big that market might be?
I don't know. And I don't know how popular they were. And I think that there was a contextual issue with Amazon singles. And it was a neat idea. It was a very neat idea. And that was for Amazon wanted to encourage the idea of people writing, you know, shorter content stuff, essays, things like that. But a lot of things Amazon does, you know, if it doesn't catch on in a big way, it doesn't necessarily get as much of a push. Now I'm going to go look at the page here to see what are the new, now they're doing single classics and stuff. You've seen, like, right now, James Patterson, by the way, launched his Book Shots, which is his much shorter sort of content. So, you know, there is this interesting sort of space for trying to create. I think there's a big market for shorter content.
That's when he's not getting in trouble with them, right?
Yeah, so James Patterson, by the way, had announced that he was going to do a book called The Murder of Stephen King.
Oh, God. And Stephen King announced he's going to, his new book, James Patterson's Ghost Will Regret the Day It Crossed Stephen King.
So Patterson then said, yeah, we've decided not to release that book. And, I mean, wow.
What was it about? It was about Stephen King getting murdered?
King, the author, getting killed by an amalgam of Stephen King villains.
I mean, that would be parody, right?
Well, I don't think that it was a problem legally to do. I think it's just Stephen King. There are certain people who are very, very titanic in their own genres, right? Like, you don't want to piss off Steven Spielberg if you want to make movies, right? And certainly James Patterson is a giant, but even James Patterson, probably if he's doing it, and Andrew, you've read more about it than I have, but it didn't seem like he got Stephen King's blessing on
something. No, he didn't have Stephen King's blessing. And remember, Stephen King was almost murdered by a fan or murdered by somebody. So, you know, that's... there's that little factor there, you know, and so it was just a.
Are you talking about his getting hit by the car or?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean that might be manslaughter one, but you know, I don't know about murder.
Do you know about the case?
Oh yeah, no. I mean, it's an accident. The guy was distracted driving and ran over Stephen King. It was not murder. Murder has to be premeditated, or it has to be I intend to take a life.
Let's also understand that we don't know. We can't see inside the mind of Stephen King to understand how he personally processes.
Sure.
It.
Well, I know that Stephen King definitely. The guy who ran him over in the car later died, and Stephen King wrote him as an incompetent ass being manipulated by outside forces. He was not kind to the guy, and both in his book, nonfiction book, On Writing, and in the fictionalized version of his own murder or being run over or whatever, he just portrayed the guy as completely incompetent. And like it occurred, like as I'm reading it, I'm like, how did he get away with even writing this stuff? And then I read like, oh, the guy's dead. And then it's like, and then it just goes on to be unkind enough that I'm like, seems like the estate could maybe say we wish you hadn't done that or something. It was crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, there was a lot of different things that came out. So the witnesses report, there were some people that watched the van looping back and forth, and some woman said, I hope he doesn't hit somebody. And somebody else said they watched the van drive straight towards him. And so point is, somebody almost took his life.
Sure.
And so I'm saying it's kind of a anyhow, point is like that was it back in the way. Like I would say is for Patterson to say, like, I'm gonna do a book of like that's maybe won't be received all that well. But anyway, long story short, the book shots have been a Patterson initiative to create these shorter, like 150 page books, because looking at, you know, reading patterns, things like this, you can see in stores. So I think it's an interesting space. Our goal with Author Page is really just to build really good author tools. And it's not necessarily like, oh, we're going to become the name or this destination for things. It's more like we want to become the layer, a technology that you use as a writer to promote your stuff, to get your stuff out there. You know, we want you, you know, push, have an author page that pushes people to you, and you can have, you know, brianbrushwood.com/books could go to your author page and it could be invisible, and that's
sure,
fine.
Sure.
We're cool with that. So long story short though, but that's kind of a goal, kind of where we want to go. And somebody brought up a question. This is a really good question. What about fan fiction? You know, and you know, what about fan fiction that uses the names of existing characters? And that gets to be a troublesome area. So if somebody said, hey, I got this really cool Harry Potter fan fiction, it uses the Harry Potter characters, can I go and sell this? Well, the answer is you probably can't. Legally, you have a problem there because you're using somebody else's IP. And that's why, you know, sites that allow you to share fan fiction and stuff, you know, have to be very careful in how they present and what they offer to people, because if you say, yes, pay for this story, then you're effectively profiting directly off of that IP. If you have a site and you have advertising there and people post those stories, somebody could make a claim. And the reality is, it's not a matter, are you legally in the right? It's, can you legally protect your right to do these things in the face of people who have more money and more lawyers?
Yeah.
So I my answer to that is like, hey, you know, I think, you know, Henry Peter and Maladroit, you know, are two great characters, you know. Yeah. You know, it's you know, change some of that out you know, that gets to be, that's been a thing that's been asked up repeatedly about, like, can we do, can I sell fan fiction? And it's like, well, the answer is going to be is like, if you can't legally sell it, then the answer would be no, you know. Amazon tried to do something with their Kindle Worlds where they had authorized fan fiction. And so, you know, Peter Wax, he's written, he has a book out that is set in the Heroes universe. Mm-hmm. So, and that was done with the full authorization of there. And they have things where other people can go in there and you can, anybody can go in there and say, hey, I want to write a story in this universe or whatever. The problem is you look at a lot of the content there and some of it's sort of like some of the IP, and it's not like you're eager to sort of write in some of these areas.
Sure.
It's an interesting idea, but and a lot of them are just like,
these are the universes that you can write in.
Mm-hmm.
The Southern Shifters universe.
Some are cool. Some like they have like
the CW show, the 100 is here.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first one that I've recognized so far, I think.
Yeah. So it's an interesting, I think these are the ones like, I'm trying to figure out, like, yeah, some of them, like anybody can contribute a right to it. And I think you have to follow certain ground rules, which is interesting, but it becomes this, when you, things are no longer canon though, you know, does that diminish the value? And certainly I would say that for a lot of people, a fan fiction, it doesn't matter. They just want a great story. So here's the content guidelines for Veronica Mars, pornography. Can't have pornographic or offensive descriptions or sexual acts. No offensive stuff, which racial slurs, excessively graphic, illegal and infringing content, poor customer experience, use of brands. So you can't write a Veronica Mars.
Veronica Mars got behind the wheel of her Ford F-150. She squeezed the grips tightly as she realized that 300 horsepower engine would get her across town.
This is the best car I've ever driven, she exclaimed.
Bryce, can you go back to that?
Yeah. Near the bottom, like, there's some more specific stuff.
So, you can't include any of their side characters. The stories must be, can't take place during the period of which the television show took place.
May not include any of the Veronica Mars series characters in the years
after she's in college.
Huh. And it's a very interesting sort of, you know, area. But, you know, I don't read fan fiction, but heck, you know, it's a huge, huge market, you know, but it's trying to capitalize. That's problematic. So the short answer is basically, we can't really legally let people do that. So, you know,
we're doing a thing tomorrow for the Contender. We actually had like a big meeting yesterday, kind of just going over what our strategy is for the debates, the election, the holidays, just kind of everything all put together. And we had tremendous success selling a 11 card expansion that we had made for the cons. And we had sold them as a con exclusive, but we had like 60 of them left over. So put out a mailing list blast. I told everybody, like, pump the mailing list a little bit on the podcast and on the social. And then, you know, blew out the mailing list on Wednesday, and we sold out of all 62 that we had remaining in about 3 hours. And they were 10 card or 11 cards for $10, which, considering we, you know, our base deck is 500 cards for $30, is a tremendous.
It makes you realize that it's not the price per card that motivates people to buy.
It's new, right? And especially because we are in a genre in which people love playing the game. It's a very replayable game. And yet, you do kind of need a little bit of new blood into the game to kind of to juice it if you're going to play it over and over and over and over again. This has been something interesting. The other thing is, and this is something that I really probably wouldn't talk about if it weren't on this show where we're kind of behind the scenes a little bit. Those cards were not done by the card company that we made all the other cards with.
Oh, shoot.
This is another more on-demand card solution. And nobody has given us any kind of feedback that the cards are bad.
Mm.
Right? So it got us thinking. Because we had always been under the impression that even if we did any kind of you know, cards based on the debates that are going to happen over the next month and a half, and the first one will be tomorrow, we would kind of have to wait to the end, get the best, run the, you know, try to run it as fast as we can, probably with the card company that we already work with, and then, you know, sell them in and around Election Day. But because we've had such a great reaction to the TV and movie presidents thing, not only at the cons where we sold them, but also this week, we've kind of sort of shifted our thinking. And I think, we're definitely going to do 3 10-card expansions for each of the debates as they happen, you know. So we'll put out the email blast the day before or the day of, as it is tomorrow because it's Monday, and then they are going to people will be able to pre-buy them. We'll figure out exactly how many we should order, and then you know, put them out. But I think it'll be at the same price point. But I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where, for us, it was really hard, I think, to turn our head on exactly, you know, what's viable. What do people want? You know, and then also to decouple what we know is an issue, which is that, you know, by all accounts, it is fairly clear now that we overbought on base decks to an almost comical degree. And that's fine, right? Like, you know, because we're not tremendously close or tremendously far away from breaking even. We're not totally underwater. The company's not bankrupt. So great. We made a gigantic mistake, but we survived it. But at the same time, we look at all these boxes and we're like, well, we got to get these the hell out of here. But that might not be the same solution as giving the people that already own your product more things that they would like. You know? Well, that's kind of a bit of an eye opening thing for us over the last.
That's the brilliance of the Starbucks model. Before Starbucks, a cup of coffee was a cup of coffee was a cup of coffee. But then Starbucks figured out, oh wait, we can sell more than a cup of coffee. The cup of coffee will be the product that they buy, but what they're really buying is a quiet place with some hip music that has good Wi-Fi that they could get some work done, and we'll never charge for that. That's free for everyone. But we're going to flip everything on its ear, and once you are associated with our tribe, once you identify as somebody who likes stopping in at Starbucks, we will figure out a way to allow you to spend as much money as you want to spend with a whole bunch of add-ons. And of course, you know, the actual material, the base cup of coffee is what, you know, $1.99 or whatever, or you can get a grande for $7.99, or you could get spice added for another $2. Like, they invented a way to make it possible to spend $14.99 on a cup of coffee. That did not exist before Starbucks. And in that regard, you are making it possible to figure out, what do you want to spend for the contender? How much is the base deck? Like $20, $29?
$30,
$30. Yeah. So you can spend $30 and have the contender, or, and this is what you're getting towards, you can figure out a way to allow somebody to spend $89 on the contender. And the more of those options that you have, the better off you're going to be, because now you're getting an accurate reflection of how deeply people are enjoying the experience, and something that balances the scales a bit.
So Tramput points out something very interesting that, you know, also to consider, you're trying to ping the same pit of people for money with the cards. So $10 for a once a year thing is fantastic, but $10 a hit 4 times in a year for 1/5 of the original game price is a question mark. And that's something that we were far more on the tram side, where it's like, listen, we initially didn't make those packs to sell at all. They were just going to be throw-ins for people to buy the larger package at the conventions. Like, that we did not make them for sale, right? And it was only because we had so many people coming up at Gen Con that had already bought everything that we had made that were like, I just want that. Like, what is the price on that? That I came up with the fairly, I thought, like, pricey, like $10. And they were like, nobody batted an eye. Everybody just threw $10 and that was it. And then we put it out there and they sold again, like that, putting them out there. You know, we sold them out so fast that I think we had more people coming and abandoning their, or they didn't get to abandon checkout because they weren't able to put it in their cart. But we had more people coming to that page than bought it, far more. So it's like, I don't know whether or not in an off year we could sell $10 expansions, right? For like three of them within a 1.5 month period. And who knows whether or not we'll be able to do it now. You know, the beauty of our on-demand printing solution now is that we can pre-sell it, have a good sense of how many we need, and then order them, you know. And we'll see where it goes. I genuinely don't know. But I do know this, that there's going to be close to 100 million people watching that election. And a fair amount of people of them have this game, right? And at some point, someone's going to say something that everybody remembers for weeks, if not years, to come. And in that Venn diagram, our tiny little satellite to the gigantic viewing audience, I am curious to see how many people are going to want that, you know, binders full of women card in their contender deck, and whether or not they would be willing on an impulse purchase to spend $10 on it.
Well, and that's the other thing too, is that you if price is truly a concern, just take some index card and write down whatever quotes you want on there. You know, I mean, it's like I don't know that there should be any hesitation whatsoever at you figuring out a way to continuously, you know, respond to the people who are saying to you, I like that you are doing, I like what you do. I want you to keep doing new stuff and keep figuring out ways for me to throw money at you.
Well, and here's what we've gotten. We got way more criticism, which is not a ton, but to say that there has been criticism of us discounting the main game or discounting the larger expansions than we've ever had for offering like far higher price per card expansions.
Yeah.
Nobody's batted an eye at a $10, 11 card expansion. People have written angry Amazon reviews because we did a sale where the price of the base deck came down a fair amount for
a temporary amount of time. Yeah.
Right. You know, so that's, you know, that's what it is. You know, I'm curious. I don't know what the best way is. We're going to try to do it. I mean, obviously the goal for us is to make as much money as possible, but we are sensitive to the idea that, you know, we don't want to make the audience think, might make our customers think that we're bleeding them. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And also there is I think that the value proposition on this is a little bit different because there's like the rush printing element of it, right? Like we're going to say, look, we're doing high velocity, small batch expansions, and we are going to write them as they're happening. And we are going to get them to our printer ASAP, and we are going to get them to you ASAP. So that, I think, as a value proposition is different than us just saying we've been working for 3 months on these 10 cards and they cost $10.
I just love the fact that there's the ability now to do the on demand. And when you first started this, we had conversations about that where I was, you know, lamenting the fact that when you first started, there really wasn't, you know, an on demand element to make it possible and easier to do this.
Yeah. Oh, no. You definitely have made, made a lot of great points that, I think considering what the reaction was to it. Now, I do think that there is the element of, even if these are not the same quality, the fact that the initial thing was of great quality. I don't know. I'll tell you what, one of these days, I'm just, you know, either in an After Things or in a Medium post, like, we are going to get a, like, you know, 90s gangster rap diss track from me about some elements of the production of tabletop card games, because I have a deep anger in my soul, and one day, despite my best efforts to be civil, it will spew forth like hot lava. But I will say this, the quality and reaction that we have seen from on-demand printing has been, you know, certainly not perfect, but seems to be pretty good. Yeah, so just to react to some of the people in the chat room, Tram says, what about a PDF? Something that can be sold on a yearly basis that people can print and expand their decks at a price. I'm all for PDF stuff. You know, I don't know if now is the time to do it. I mean, I think now, I mean, if we're in a world of like make hay while the sun's high, we are at high noon right now. We're about to have the most watched debate of all time, and we're a card game about debating. So that is something where I think, yeah, in the future, I'm all for PDF stuff. I mean, that was one of the biggest lessons I got from working with Andrew, that like, you know, I'd look at what we made selling stuff, and then I'd look at what we made to literally just oversee a transaction that would happen while we were both at Arby's, and be like, man, tell you what, you can get the right kind of material. PDF stuff is really rad.
Yeah, and we also found that like with our, when we would do our books, was that I've never done a hardbound book in the magic industry. And I've had people like, oh, like, you know, people only want to buy hardbound books and stuff. I'm like, I think there's a model for that, but the cost of doing hardbound was so much more expensive than just doing paperback or combbound. I'm like, if people want the information, they don't care the format. Like I used to, well, as a kid, I used to buy these Paul Osborne illusion plans, which are these, you know, 70-page booklets or books with, you know, delusion designs. I didn't care. Like actually being combbound made it easier to read. And that was my model, was like, if the content's really good and the medium supports that, you know, don't try to build your valuation primarily on the fact that it's hardbound or hardcover or whatever. And I think there are cases where that help enhances stuff, but I would rather build my valuation on the content itself, because, you know, we never lost money on a book. We never lost money on any titles we put out there, because our cost of recoupment was so low, was extremely low. And then when you go to digital, obviously it's even better, but you know, the trade-off on digital, you know, it you know, really depends on the demographic of the content. But man, I'm excited that you have this option of on-demand, Justin, because that means that whatever you want to do next, it's not going to be the same financial burden. It's going to be a creative challenge, but it won't be this, I need to pony up, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to do it.
I mean, and there's a lot of lessons. Lessons from the first thing, and they will be applied to anything that goes forward. And you know, I don't know. We're gonna see. We're gonna do an email blast and a Kickstarter update tomorrow morning, basically alerting everybody that the Battle of New York expansion pack is currently on sale, and that will be called and spun from what we see tomorrow with the first debate at Hofstra University. And then we're just going to see, you know, we're going to see where that goes. Mm-hmm. Because what I'm curious about is, A, how much as a pre-sale it does. And then we're going to do another email the day after, the Tuesday morning, with the actual cards. You know, so let's say, who knows what the catchphrase from the debate tomorrow night will be. I'm almost positive there will be one. Somebody will say something very memorable, right? Odds on that are fairly high. But I'm curious how many people just know that want to bet on the idea that this is a thing, and then how many people want to buy it when that's actually on the card. And now you can visualize, oh, I might get to say blank during a contender game. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the process. Gentlemen, picks?
That's a good question. I had a my pick is Space Pirate Trainer Beta. Full beta is out. Man, that thing is coming together. It's amazing. If you have a Vive, can't recommend it enough. And you're not contributing to a platform that funds Donald Trump's meme machines.
Or do you know?
That's exactly. Yeah, I'm sorry. That's me trying to lean on a newsworthy thing that happened this week. I actually don't care one way or the other. But the anyway.
Oh, hear that? Brian Brushwood does not care does not about care. People again.
No, the additions really. The new weapons are rad. The new Justin, you started playing this, right?
I have not gotten a chance beyond when I was with you. So no, I played a little bit with you, but that's it so far.
There's a new gameplay mechanic, and that you can reach back for a shield or a kind of lightsaber looking thing that is like a whip to whip around the drones. But also, I didn't even notice. You could see it here in the video that we're watching. But apparently, that thing also reflects back their own shots so back
any
at them.
Field, yeah,
yeah, and then but it also allows a strategic element where there are these power-ups, and you could grab power-ups and set them down next to you so that you can open them up later when you need them. It's man, it's really coming along nicely. This whole VR world is just extraordinary.
Yeah, man. No, it's never a bad time when you get to turn people on to VR and turning on Adam Curry, who, if you are familiar with Adam Curry as a person, as a public figure, or listen to his shows, the one thing that is uncontroversial about somebody who very often courts controversy is that he is strident in his opinions, mm-hmm. right? And that dude was skeptical putting on the headset and came out singing the
childlike. I mean, he was just giddy. Like, it was amazing to see how much fun he was having.
So, go ahead and check it out. My pick is, I'm trying to think if there's something that we used.
Well, I'll give you a time fill. My reaction, and we talked about this before, you know, I'd played with a lot of different virtual reality, Oculus, everything else like that. And, you know, I'd, you know, show the cardboard to people at an Android phone just for doing that. And be like, oh, that's cool. And Mary's like, oh, that's really cool. That's really neat. When you do the Vive, you're like, I have had a religious experience. Yeah. You know, it's not like, I had a cool vacation. It was neat. Like, no, guys, my name is Moonbeam. Two right now. I've shaved my head. I'm a believer. This is the thing. And that's sort of the difference that for me was the Vive, and for a lot of people was. And it was part of it was just the room sensing, just that it's not like you're not your head's fixed on a post. It was like, oh my God, this responds to my body moving.
Yeah. So. No, like the virtual presence, I mean, you really feel like you're in a different place, and you forget that you're in, you know, this crude flesh, and then you just wish you could download your brain to a robot body.
It's so amazing that you like forget and defend the fact that it is a literal death trap, and it invites you and gives you delicious opportunities to punch your lamps and walls.
Oh yeah, well no, there's definitely damage to the back of the set over here. I don't know if you can see.
We tried. Like, we had we tried to scuff it. I thought it was just a scuff, but you can't get it out. Yeah, it's rough right now.
Cracked from where I was whipping something, and
that's gonna be like realtors. That's gonna be like on a Craigslist listing and all that. Previous occupants were not Vive users.
Exactly. Yeah, again, non-smokers basically.
No Vive users allowed.
But no, you apologize for it. You're like, well, it wasn't really the game. I mean, like, I should have known that, you know, like, I should have said, I saw the grid. I didn't think about it.
It wasn't real. It was that reality in there was more real than this artificial grid put in front of you.
Well, and that's one of the things, like, people are all like, oh, great, we're heading for a world where everyone just stays in their honeycomb and virtual everything. I'm like, yeah, because while the landscape will be fake, the friendships will be real and the joy will be real.
I like that. Yeah, we're heading for this world. We're just going to head in front of there. No, excuse me. I got to go back and watch cable news.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, whatever. Like, we're going to go to the UK in a week and a half, and we're going to meet, by and large, people that we've never met personally, but we have deep friendships with. We're going to go out to Bristol for a day and meet, you know, Terpster, who's built an empire and interacting with people online. We're going to stay with Will Harris, and you know, he came to our wedding based on a friendship that we made almost solely online. So whatever. I feel like that whole argument's crazy pants with silly sauce.
Some of my best friends are virtual friends. I have a pick.
Go.
Yeah.
It's a pricey pick. And again, I'm going to preface this. You have to put these caveats here when you enter into certain discussions, because I would say certain factions, I'm going to say one faction's way more vocal than another faction, but they'll get upset and be vocal about that. But
the liberal media. Sorry.
Yeah. I skipped out the last iPhone. I had the iPhone 6. I didn't do the iPhone 6S. I thought it was kind of cool, but it wasn't one of those, like, it was the first time I did not upgrade, because I'm like, it kind of like, it was one of the things too, like, my qualification was going to be a couple months after it came out, and then I kind of like, I'm happy, and, you know, like, the enthusiasm went past, and I'm like, I ended up not upgrading, and then I went and got the iPad Pro, which I loved. And I'm using more and more for drawing and other stuff, content creation and stuff. I did jump on board the iPhone 7, the Plus, and I love, again, whatever phone, if you have an Android phone or something you like and you're happy with, that's great. I am not here to tell you why you need to switch or why you need to do what, because everybody's different. For me, I've played with both platforms for me and what I like to do, like to use. I love the iPhone system, much of it. Some things I don't like. I use, you know, I've just now only started to use Apple Maps because Waze wants to track you in the background, which when you're not using the app, which is to me dumb and unnecessary and invasive. So I don't use, you know, I've switched over.
Hold on. I mean, that's how Google, when you use Google Maps, like, Google's always done that, right? I mean,
I don't use Google Maps.
Okay, but that's how they know, like, you enjoy the benefit of having an estimated drive time that's accurate, right?
I don't use either of those. I don't use anything that tracks me when I'm not in it.
Sure. As far as you know,
true.
My point is if you like being able to open Google Maps and it's saying that it'll take 15 minutes for you to get that 3 miles and that turning out to be accurate, the price for that, the way that is possible, is the background tracking on there.
Well, that's a feature that hasn't been useful to me, number one.
Okay,
and I'm
right.
Talking about Waze.
Got it. Okay. All right.
Yeah. It's not been worth it for me. Two, it's that when I'm dealing with companies that primarily their business model is advertising and using that data, that I'm less excited to share that data. And when I have no opt-out, like Waze, I cannot say don't track me in the background, don't ping and see where I'm shopping or what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Not interested in doing it. And I'm like, yes, other places do that. But I would say Apple's business model is selling you products. Its primary business model and yes, they do advertising, but part of the reason advertisers don't like to use them is because they won't give them the data other people do. Mm-hmm. And it's not a matter of like, oh, I'm paranoid. Nobody cares what I do. But as far as how I want to participate in this economy or whatever like that, I'm not into encouraging.
You don't want to give your dollar vote to moving in that direction.
Yeah, I don't. I would rather encourage my dollar vote for me pay you for a service that I like rather than you say, okay, how do we exploit every bit of data we have about this person to advertisers and third parties? That's a choice. It's not – you can make – everybody else can make their own choice, but I much prefer to buy stuff than to – then because also you may feel it's free, but it's not. And it also makes things more expensive because every advertising dollar they have to spend to Google or whatever to sell you something by pushing these advertisements toward you, it comes back through the prices through stuff. Mm. So – content, you know, things that like this service is free here, but yeah, when you eventually go buy a product or buy this, you're paying for that thing in some other way, and it's going through two or three third parties, and it actually increases the cost of that. Mm-hmm. So, anyhow, my point is that I love, you know, I've been very happy with this phone. I think the camera on it is absolutely fantastic. I've loved the idea of doing the one tap telephoto. It's been extremely useful. A lot of the little functions they've added in there are great. There's been a lot of great features that have been on other phones that are finally coming here, and you know, also the vice versa. The speed has been incredible. The speed of which this is working, and I was happy with the speed of my 6, right? And I switched over this, and the speed on this has been even more incredible. I've been shooting video using the 4K mode with the really good chip segment, and I've been blown away by the quality of that. Like, you know, you're shooting 4K, you can shoot on a phone, and there are Android phones that have 4K video too. You can shoot on a phone now a higher resolution than, you know, your first digitally shot movies for the first decade, you know, the early the Star Wars movies from the 90s, whatever. You have a higher resolution now, and with the right cameras and stuff, you can choose incredibly, you know, neat stuff. So I'm very, very happy with this, whatever. So I was very pleased with the upgrade. If I can just figure out where to plug my headphone in, I'll be fine. So that's my pick. So if you're thinking about it, you're on the fence, whatever, I've been very happy.
Yeah, 7 Plus, I've loved it. It's the first time that between iPhone or iOS 10 and the 7 Plus, it's the first time in a very long time that I've really felt like, okay, this, I like the changes done in iOS 10. I like the speed in which you can, you know, take advantage of it. It feels very, very put together, and a little bit more on purpose maybe than some of the stuff in the past. It's great. And it's fast as hell. Tell you what, for anybody still playing Pokemon Go, if you do your lucky egg trick where you can get the double points, if you just start your evolutions and then immediately once it starts evolving, cancel it out, just close the app and reopen it, the iPhone 7 Plus is so fast that it will reopen and restart faster than the animation takes to show your evolution. So wow. You can do like twice the amount of...
Justin just sold 100 phones right there.
Yeah. Ha! So I'm sure eventually they'll push some thing to stop it. But right now that is a hack that pretty much just takes advantage of the fact that the iPhone 7 Plus just has like this insane processing power.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, you don't, your life is going to be complete regardless of whatever is in your pocket. And that's the thing is that it's this, you know, we don't need to buy things because we think we have to have them. You buy them because things are useful. And for many people, a base Android phone, whatever, has the amount of functionality and things it can do is insane. And if you told people, you know, you look at like, I have like a $50 Kindle Fire, you know, which was based, used the Android system as the base operating system on there. Compared to my iPads, like, yeah, it's like, oh my God, this is a nightmare. But by itself and using it alone, it's awesome. They're wonderful. It's an absolutely wonderful thing. And the things that it can do is great. So, you know, if you're inclined, great. If you're not, it's not like, well, you're missing out on the revolution, you know.
All right, real quick, last pick. This is something that I did this week that I really, really, really enjoyed. If you are in the Bay Area, I suggest you do it. It's called Speakeasy. Speakeasy SF, I believe, is the website. It is an immersive theater experience.
Mm.
You find yourself within a speakeasy on a very, very specific night, and you kind of find out why it's specific by the end of it, in San Francisco, and you have three rooms to interact in: a cabaret where a show is going on the entire time that you're there, a bar, and a casino. You can buy chips, you buy drinks. It is really, really well done. You can, they also added a little backstage area that you can also mill around in, and you can then also see through a double mirror into the dressing room for the showgirls, and you can hear all the conversations that they're having. And then you can also see into the boss's office. So you also get elements of theatricality that are supposed to be in private, but you have an omniscience into. It's insane to think of the logistics of what you have to put that kind of stuff together. And then to also make it a fun place where you can actually get a drink and you have a good time. They said, I saw it when it was in an old facility, and then that got sold out from under them, and they rebuilt this new place, which is in North Beach, which is kind of a better, more historical place for it to take place in general. But man, it was super fun. It was just as fun as the first time. And if you are in the Bay Area, it's pricey. I'm just going to let you know, man, because like we saw it in previews where it was $85 a ticket, and apparently it's going up to $110. And that's before you get, your $10 drinks that you're getting, which say that they're 10 cents on the menu, but they have not held to prohibition era pricing.
Ha!
It's pricey to do, but man, it's such a unique and fun experience, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
Man. Another one of these, you know, we've talked this before, kind of the experiential adventures, you know, and I'm excited about more of these coming about.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing is a lot of people compare it to Speak No More, which is the Macbeth immersive theater performance out there in New York. I've not seen Sleep No More, so I can't comment on it specifically. But as I understand it, that's a little bit more abstract, and this is a little bit more genre. This is about, you know, cops and robbers and deceit and jealousy and greed and like very, you know, kind of like pulp 20s sort of stuff to it.
Awesome. Gentlemen,
I'd like to say thank you to all of our Patreon supporters listening to this right now on our feed. Because of you, you make this possible. Good or bad, we're happy. Yeah. It's been After.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.